Hello, welcome. I'm Liz Sullivan, the project director of the Next America Project, and today's an exciting day for CSIS. It's an institution probably most well known for the policy ideas generated by our senior scholars, but today we're going to turn the focus to hear from some young professionals and see what they have to think about foreign policy. Last summer, CSIS launched the Next America Project to better understand how this next generation of rising leaders really sees America's place in the world. Nearly 2,000 young professionals and students participated and have generated their own solutions to some of the most critical challenges facing the U.S. global engagement. In many ways, it has become commonplace to say that the millennial generation shares a unique worldview. We are technologically savvy and comfortable operating in a globalized and interconnected world. Polling suggests that most of us consider ourselves to be citizens of the world rather than simply citizens of the United States. CSIS set out to engage 18 to 30-year-olds in a series of online debates. Today, we'll hear from a panel of Next America Fellows to discuss what these debates tell us about how young people view issues such as foreign assistance and nuclear disarmament. But first, I'd like to share with you a message from John Hamry, our CEO, who regrettably was unable to join us today.
Welcome, everybody. I'm glad that you're here. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president of CSIS. This is a big day, and I'm sad that I can't be with you. I'm in Paris.
Real sad.
So I'm kind of glad to be there, but I'm sorry to miss the chance to be with all of you. This was a very important initiative for CSIS. And let me just say a word of how it started. We had the opportunity to look at some very interesting data, polling data, that suggested that the rising generation thinks about the world in very different ways from my generation. I hate to say it, in better ways than my generation. My generation has produced a lot of problems. Your generation is quite interested in solving them. So we thought we would try to tap into this enormous creative talent base that exists in this rising generation to try to give us all a pathway forward. And I'm excited by what has been accomplished so far. Our goal was ambitious, which was to try to ignite a new debate, a big debate among the rising generation, recruiting large numbers of people to be involved. And I'm very pleased at what we've seen. We've seen a very rigorous and active debate among the participants in the Next Generation Project. I think there have been tens of thousands of hits on the website, a very active policy debate among the participants, and interesting new ideas. And ultimately, that's what it's about. All of you who are here today are participating in the expansion of this idea, the idea that a rising generation can bring something fresh to a policy debate. And for that, I'm very grateful. I say, I am sorry not to be with you. I know I would gain a lot from hearing you, but I will be listening and following up on the progress of this conference. I hope it's a start. I hope it's not an end. I think a conference like this is meant to give all of us a chance to get together and to share a common frame of reference. In many ways, it's like that little prism of glass we played with when we were kids in our first science class. You know, somehow light comes from all over, goes through that prism, and it comes out coordinated a little bit in a beautiful rainbow of colors. That's what I hope comes from this conference today and from all of you joining us. Thanks for being here.
All right. We are extremely privileged to have with us as our featured speaker, Derek Chollet. He currently serves as the Principal Deputy Director of the State Department's Office of Policy Planning. Derek is a rising star in the policy world. He has served as a senior foreign policy advisor for various campaigns and senior officials, including advising Senator John Edwards, serving as special advisor to Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbott, and as speechwriter for Ambassador Richard Holbrooke while he was serving as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. He has written extensively, including a terrific book, America Between the Wars, from 11-9 to 9-11. Mr. Chollet is also a CSIS alum, and we are thrilled that he is joining us today. There is no one better to speak on these issues and maybe even offer a bit of advice to the young leaders gathered here today. Please join me in welcoming Derek.
Thanks, everybody. It's great to be back here at CSIS. I spent two of the best years of my professional life here a little bit ago. And, you know, they say that in government, you know, you don't have any time to read or really learn anything new. So you're constantly just using the resources that you built up over time before you joined government and just depleting them until you run out and leave government. And I have to say, I learned a lot in my 2 years here as a young professional. And I've drawn on my experiences here, both specific in terms of issues as well as just general in terms of how to operate in this town over and over and over. It's also great to be at an event like this for young professionals. First, I'm always reassured when I'm included in an event with young professionals. But also, you know, this is the kind of organization and a kind of effort that when I was, you know, starting out in Washington about 20 years ago, actually, there was nothing like this around. And for those of us who were engaged in foreign policy and trying to sort of break into the professional ranks, we didn't have a place like this where we could go and exchange ideas with our peers and learn new ideas and hear from speakers and whatnot. And so I think it's just a wonderful venture you've started. I think it's a great credit to Dr. Hamry and CSIS for pumping so much energy and resources into this, and it's a great credit to all of you for participating in this. And I think, you know, the fact you're starting now at this point in your career, it's only going to continue to pay dividends over and over and over as you continue to advance in this field. So I really congratulate all of you. And what I'd like to try to do today is rather than sort of talk at you and I'll dispense with my prepared remarks and try to offer a few insights at the front and then just kind of really open it up to questions. I'm more interested, as Dr. Hamry said, the exchange of ideas and hearing from you and what's on your minds, both in terms of comments and questions, rather than just spend my time lecturing at you. So why don't I just give you a brief sense of kind of how, from the policy planning staff's perspective in the new administration, how we're looking at the world. I mean, obviously, much has been made of you know, when the Obama administration came into office, the considerable challenges we face around the world and the sort of somewhat daunting inheritance that we face. I mean, it's often said that, you know, it's hard to think of a presidential transition that was so perilous than, you know, perhaps maybe since, you know, April 1945 when FDR passed away and Truman took over, and that just a range of challenges that this administration is having to face all at once. Multitasking is something that we have had to learn how to do. But that sense, we're still sort of approaching things from a sense of priority, and this is kind of in no particular order. But, you know, as we look out at sort of where we want to be 4 years from now at the end of the first term, or even 8 years from now at the end of a second term, what do we want to have shown by way of accomplishment? And you're starting to see that as sort of as it takes form over the past few months in terms of looking forward and laying the groundwork for policies down the road. And I think, first of all, the obvious point is we're trying to position ourselves in the world, the administration, the U.S. generally, to take on the big global challenges and to put the United States in a position where we are in the solutions business of tackling some of those global challenges. Those are things like, for example, global climate change. I mean, this administration came into office, President Obama campaigned for office with a very strong set of initiatives on global climate change. And I think, you know, partially we're forced to do it by events. The planet's getting warmer. We also have a serious negotiation underway that's going to culminate later this year in Copenhagen. But I think early on, you've seen very deep engagement across the board from the administration, both in the White House as well as at the State Department, where Secretary Clinton and President Obama appointed a special envoy for climate change, Todd Stern, to really begin tackling this issue head on. And that's something we've begun to do. The second issue, nonproliferation. The president gave a very important speech in Prague a few months ago, which he laid out a very bold agenda on nonproliferation issues, the headline of which is to try to set forth a sort of roadmap to achieve a nuclear weapons-free world, something that, you know, is very ambitious but has got a lot of support on the outside. In fact, it's one of those ideas where a group of very influential outsiders, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Sam Nunn, and Bill Perry, came up with an idea and championed it and sort of worked from the outside in and forced many of those in government or on the campaign trail to embrace it. Flowing from the ambition of trying to achieve a nuclear weapons-free world, we're trying to do things like get the CTBT ratified. We're also working to strengthen the nonproliferation treaty, work on further arms reductions with Russia. Again, these are things that are going to take a lot of time to achieve, and frankly, we may not be able to achieve them within the span of the first term. But that's another global issue where this administration has dove in to the deep end of the pool to try to accomplish. Another issue certainly would be the global financial crisis. I mean, I think that's in terms of just newsprint and airtime and kilobytes spent in terms of discussing issues. Certainly the position towards the global financial crisis is something we've had no choice but to face. But again, I think whether it was working through the G20 process or some of the initiatives that the president has launched here at home are all interlinked in trying to put the United States in a position where we're not only reforming our own system, but also reforming the global system in tackling global financial issues. And I think, again, it's an issue that 4 years from now, we hope that we have established a new architecture for international finance and economics that can put us in a position where we're not yet repeating the same crisis 10 years from now, or hopefully even 50 years from now. The other kind of global issue that we're spending a tremendous amount of time thinking about and trying to figure out how to tackle is this issue of sort of violent extremism. I mean, some call it the challenge of ungoverned spaces, but it's basically how we try to sort of wean people away from the ideologies and the temptation to either fight against a state, whether it be their own state, or to perpetrate attacks against innocents, whether the United States or whether they're in the Swat Valley or in India. Again, that's an issue that doesn't have a clean answer. It's not simply a diplomatic issue. It's not just a military issue, certainly. It's also a development issue. But it's something we're spending a tremendous amount of time thinking about how, as a government, we approach the question of violent extremism and how we can work with others around the world to try to end violent extremism. Those are kind of some of the big global challenges and the kind of the first basket of global issues we're looking at. The administration also is set forth in thinking another kind of basket of issues of how we deal with the great or rising powers. Something that we at the State Department have been deeply involved in the first few months is setting a new framework for our relationships with key countries, for example, China and India. Those are two countries, actually, which, to give credit for the previous administration, we made a tremendous amount of progress in the 8 years, building in many ways on the progress that was made under the Clinton administration in putting ourselves on a solid footing with both India and China. What President Obama and Secretary Clinton and the rest of the administration are trying to do is reestablish a framework to set us, put us in a good position to move forward in the next 4 to 8 years. With China, Secretary Clinton and Secretary Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, are going to be co-chairing a strategic and economic dialogue with China, which is the framework from which we will be discussing a whole range of both bilateral, regional, and global issues that we hope we can work with China together on. It's not always going to be easy, and the fact we've merely established a framework, the first meeting of this dialogue is going to be at the end of July here in Washington, where Geithner and Clinton will meet with their Chinese counterparts. But the framework is, again, in and of itself, it doesn't deliver anything, but it provides a mechanism from which we can discuss some of the more challenging issues that we face, whether they are these global questions like climate change or nonproliferation, or some of the difficult regional challenges, for example, North Korea, but also bilateral issues, for example, human rights or our economic issues. With India, we're trying to do something very similar. I was actually just in New Delhi a couple weeks ago. I know actually several floors up from here we're having an important discussion, I'm sorry I'm missing, by CSIS's own Tezi Schaefer on the new direction of U.S.-Indian relations. But Secretary Clinton will be visiting India later this summer, and there again she hopes to establish a new framework for U.S.-Indian relations moving forward. It's a relationship that has progressively gotten better over the last 10 to 15 years. In the last few years, it was mainly driven by the civil nuclear deal. And what we're hoping to do is, with the success of that deal achieved by the last administration, we're going to be able to move forward on a new agenda, and again, in which we're going to approach a whole vast range of issues, stuff we can do together, whether it's in the region or around the world, but also things that we can work on within our own two countries. Certainly, India's got tremendous challenges on health and poverty issues that we believe we can help them on. But in addition to sort of the big global issues and these so-called great power issues, we also have to find a way to handle the most acute crises that we inherited. Again, this is sort of self-evident, but it's hard to understate the amount of time and energy these are taking inside the administration. And here I'm speaking of Afghanistan and Pakistan, in which the administration spent the first few months in office in a major strategic review, which outlined a new strategy for how we're going to approach Afghanistan and Pakistan. Key to that strategy is actually looking at these issues as in some ways, a single theater, and that you can't de-link the challenges of Afghanistan and Pakistan. We also have a lot of work to do in Iraq, in which, again, one of the first things this president did in office was announce a new strategy with Iraq, which the centerpiece of which was reducing the number of combat forces there. We're in the middle of that right now. We're on a path to sort of to meet our commitment in Iraq, which is to have all of our combat forces out by the end of 2011. But that does not mean our business with Iraq will be over by the end of 2011. In fact, for us at the State Department, this is an issue we realize is going to be moving more and more solely onto the State Department's plate as it goes from a DOD military-led mission to a State Department mission. We will still have an embassy in Baghdad. We will still have an ambassador in Baghdad. We will still have tremendous interest inside of Iraq. So the challenge of making sure this transition is done in a responsible way, in a way that still meets the core interests that we have in Iraq and the region, as the president has outlined, is something that we're spending a lot of time thinking about at the department. Obviously, North Korea, in the news every day, extremely challenging, extremely unpredictable. You know, this administration came into office committed to re-energize negotiations through the six-party talks. Obviously, the North Koreans have had something else in mind. And in terms of maintaining stability on the Korean Peninsula and throughout Asia, while at the same time trying to maintain an opening for some diplomatic resolution of their nuclear weapons program and their ambitions, it's something, you know, every day senior policymakers are dealing with this. And finally, obviously, on Iran, I mean, in the news, in the headlines every day now, again, an issue where this president ran for office with a commitment to take a new diplomatic tack towards Iran, has begun to implement that commitment, but events on the ground, which frankly I don't think anyone, Iran expert or not, truly predicted or really frankly know where it's going, are unfolding before our eyes. So calibrating our approach to those new realities is something we're spending a lot of time doing. And that kind of goes to the what we're trying to do. Another big piece of business, which I know the Smart Power Commission here at CSIS spent a lot of time on, other think tanks around town and scholars have spent time on figuring out, is how we do things. And that's both a question of inside the U.S. government as well as how we operate in the world. I'll start with inside U.S. government. You know, Secretary Clinton has borrowed from CSIS and others the Smart Power slogan, and it's something in her confirmation testimony before the Senate. She talked about how important it is for the United States to deploy smart power around the world. And as Secretary, what she's set out to do is reorganize how the State Department operates and the wider sort of diplomatic arsenal we have and development arsenal we have operates to ensure that we have more capable smart power and a way to deploy that smart power in a way that that achieve results. A lot of that is kind of boring bureaucracy stuff. I mean, it's budgets, it's authorities, it's personnel. It's not the things that normally drive headlines. But I think one of the things that we've learned over the last 8 years is how important it is. And the reason why it doesn't get fixed is because it's really hard sometimes. You've got a lot of audiences. You've got the Capitol Hill equities. You've got obviously the internal U.S. government equities. Bureaucracies don't like change. We're fortunate in that. There's a president who fully understands and believes this. You have a secretary of state who fully understands and believes in the importance of changing the way we do business and increasing civilian capacity. And I think just as important, you have a secretary of defense who is one of the most eloquent proponents of increasing civilian capacity and creating real, true smart power. And so that development and diplomacy can stand side by side equally with defense in terms of the three legs of the stool of American power. So the administration is just now embarking, working with Congress on an effort to revitalize our the use of our diplomatic and civilian power, strengthen civilian capacity. Again, it's an area where I think folks in the government, I can speak as someone who's only been back in government for the last 5 months, have learned a lot from the work on the outside, whether it was folks actually doing the work themselves on the outside who've entered government or all the work by those here at CSIS and elsewhere and trying to understand and think about how to increase civilian capacity and help policymakers navigate some of these hard choices that have to be made when it comes to budgets and personnel and authorities. But going side by side of how we operate inside Washington and in terms of increasing our civilian capacity, we're also taking a close look at how the United States operates in the world. And you know, it's no secret that although the United States remains the most powerful country in the world by almost any measurement, economic or military, the paradox of American power, as the Smart Power Commission co-chair Joe Nye would put it, is that we're not so powerful that we can solve these global challenges on our own. We need to work with others. And I think there's a wide recognition of that in this administration. I think, frankly, there's a wide recognition of that among the American people. But saying that and believing it is different than actually doing it and ensuring that we have global institutions and the system of global governance is set up in a way that actually makes that achievable. The administration's committed to ensuring that our global institutions are as relevant as they can be to the realities of the 21st century. Again, saying that is much easier than actually doing it, particularly when you're in a situation where you have existing global institutions and there may be countries that are not part of those institutions and you're looking to add them. And there's a lot of equities at stake here. But all I can say at this point is this is a subject that the administration from the top on the way down is deeply committed to. And it's one that, for example, us at the policy planning staff are thinking very, very hard about how we make our sort of the system of global governance such as it is, whether it's the United Nations or the G8 or the G20 or the G? As relevant as it can be and as efficient as it can be and as capable as it can be to solving a lot of these global challenges that we face around the world. Before I go to Q&A, I'll just do one last pitch about how important it is for all of you to stay engaged in this effort. Again, it's not just because we need greater expertise and we need more skilled people, and we need sort of the best and the brightest in the government. It's also because whether you're in the government or out of government at a think tank or working in an advocacy organization or as a scholar at a university, we need broader public debate about these issues. I know that's something that Dr. Hamry believed in deeply when he created the Smart Power Commission. I know that that's what this organization is all about and this enterprise is all about, is just sort of widening the circle of discussion and informed kind of debate about all these challenges that we face. Because just as America is not so strong that it can solve anything alone, we in government, or even we in Washington, are not brilliant enough that we can solve it alone. And as I said, a lot of these decisions, whether they be budgetary or bureaucratic here in Washington, or just bigger decisions about how the U.S. should engage in the world or seek to reform international institutions, it requires a lot of hard choices. And we need help trying to navigate those hard choices. I know when I was in a think tank, that's sort of what I tried to do throughout my work, is to, you know, give policymakers or those, you know, whether in Congress or elsewhere, empower the tools and the insight to try to help them do their jobs a little better. And that's what I think all of you can really contribute to this debate. So I thank you for giving me the chance to speak. I look forward to your questions, comments, criticisms, general gossip, anything. Thanks. And I can just call. I don't know. Are you want people to use the mics? So use the mics.
Don't be shy.
Okay. Hi, David Greenberg from Citizens for Global Solutions.
Hey.
Wondering, I think a lot of us think that by the time that we're starting to hopefully run things, you know, hopefully
I'm really still waiting for that.
So. Let's say 15, 20 years or so, and we're like deep in the foreign policy world and everything. The way things are going right now, it looks like Brazil is going to be a major player like internationally. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what this administration and past ones and everything, like what direction we seem to be taking regarding them diplomatically, economically, so forth.
I'll just agree with your general assessment that you know, Brazil is in many ways an anchor country within the Western Hemisphere, and increasingly it's playing even a more global role. And obviously our recent history with Brazil has been a little touch and go with the previous administration, although I think it ended in an okay place. But I think this administration has high hopes for our relationship with Brazil. Actually, our new ambassador there is a career diplomat. He's not there yet, but when he gets there, he's one of the top folks we've got in the U.S. Foreign Service on Latin America. And, I mean, I think generally what the Obama administration has tried to do initially, and the president himself did this in the Summit of the Americas a few weeks ago, I guess. Secretary Clinton has done this in the couple trips she's done, I was going to say reset, but that was used with Russia. But it was kind of to reestablish the strong foundation of our relationship with Latin America. I think there was a feeling that in the previous 8 years, in some either it had gone a bit adrift, or in some ways it had gone into a negative fashion. And I think, you know, there's a sense that we need to reengage with the hemisphere, not just as bilateral relationships, whether it's U.S. Brazil or U.S. Chile, but it's also as thinking about the Western Hemisphere as an arena that is underutilized in terms of partnerships for the United States. And I think if we look at ourselves more as part of a hemisphere where we have a central role to play and we have deep interests in ensuring that the Western Hemisphere continues to progress in the way it has, you know, we've got to engage in that way. And I think that's something where we've seen some success so far. I think, you know, we've got a ways to go. But based on the discussions I've been in, you know, Brazil is definitely a central country in the Western Hemisphere, and as I said, we're seeking to even do more with it as we look out globally, not just within the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah. Hi, how you doing? I'm David Hennick with the Africa Program.
Hey.
I noticed as you talked, you didn't mention a few things, and I'm curious to know.
It wasn't an exhaustive list. It was obviously not.
But a lot of past administrations have focused on democracy, governance, and human rights.
Yep.
And I noticed you didn't explicitly mention those.
Yeah.
As I look at Africa, corruption and human rights are two of the biggest issues. And a lot of states, you know, in Africa, it's Nigeria, Equatorial Guinea.
Yep.
The U.S., you know, approach to them has taken kind of a back seat to some other interests, maybe like energy. China, you know, we haven't focused as much on human rights. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, you know, if you could comment on basically how the administration currently views issues such as democracy, governance, and human rights, and if it's kind of chilling that, you know, chilling its rhetoric on those issues.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I've seen that debate out there, or that criticism out there. You know, I think the president in Cairo gave a fairly compelling riff on democracy. I mean, it was one of the, I forget if it was seven or eight pillars of the outlined in his speech. And I think that there's, you know, so, you know, the rhetoric is out there. I don't really buy that somehow it's being downgraded. And, you know, Secretary Clinton, from her perspective, she's, you know, over the last quarter century has established a pretty long track record on democracy and human rights issues. I mean, that said, I think there was certainly, you know, and I'll speak more just as myself, as someone who was at a think tank 6 months ago, that there was, you know, a sense that in the last administration there was a lot of rhetoric about democracy, but not exactly the kind of results or even policies that you would want to hear or want to see. So I think, you know, it's governance issues generally are absolutely a key part of, say, the development and diplomacy, but particularly the development leg to the stool of American power. And I think that's, you know, how we both fund as well as the kind of programs we try to develop to improve governance is something that we're deeply committed to. The other issue, which I didn't mention, but it's certainly part of smart power, and it's something that the Secretary is absolutely seized with, is how we use new technology to change the way we conduct diplomacy. And this is something that the State Department we're doing, but also it's administration-wide. I mean, this, you know, there's no secret. President Obama got elected very much harnessing the new technology and really tapping into something different just in terms of how you campaign and get your message out. That is being translated directly into governing. And you see it not just in foreign policy, you see it across the board. But, you know, with the Cairo speech, for example, there was a very elaborate effort that was run out of the White House, but all of us throughout the government were deeply involved in it, to try to not just get the message out about the speech using new technology, but to actually show how new technology changes the message itself. I mean, we're seeing this play out in real time today on the streets of Tehran. You know, we're really seeing the power of new technology changing the way you conduct diplomacy and how politics is run. So, and I think that's part of governance, too. I mean, there's a lot in terms of transparency and accountability that you can gain from the use of new technology. So that's a... Again, oftentimes it's not seen in the framework of democracy and governance, but that's really what you're getting at. Because at least at the state, it's not we're thinking about new technology not merely as a publicity or public diplomacy thing, but also as a way it's actually changing sort of the fundamental nature of diplomacy. And the secretary appointed a senior technology advisor, which again is not just someone to sort of give her ideas on how we can get better BlackBerries, but it's about how we can actually use technology and these new technologies in a way to sort of better get results on the ground.
Hi, Jeff Beam with the Smart Power Initiative here at CSIS. One of the things we've been looking at is the level at which both the Secretary and the President have been pursuing policies that sort of match the statements related to smart power, as you alluded to Secretary Clinton's statement during her nomination hearing.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the metrics that you're using or that you're thinking about using for the future in terms of embracing a smart power approach outside of sort of higher level public diplomacy initiatives, the very successful speech in Cairo and the Al-Arabi interview given immediately after President Obama took office, those sort of upper level things. What sort of metrics are you using in that regard? Thank you.
It's a good question. Got any ideas? I'll wait to read what CSIS puts out. That's just a really good question. There are certain things you can measure, all right? Again, money, right, budget, or things that you can see, like a structure of government, you know, our government, like how we're organized to do things, that are certainly consistent with smart power. That's one of the things we probably have to develop is are the right metrics to really, I mean, it's kind of one of those you know it when you see it deals, but I think we need to do more than that. And when I was saying earlier that part of what, you know, we're embarking on at the State Department, the Secretary's embarking on, is, you know, to really give a deep dive on not just thinking about these issues but trying to institute some real reforms, is to think through the metrics a little bit. And so how we can, you know, mark time and hold ourselves accountable for what our ambitions are. But again, this isn't pre-cooked. I mean, we are working on this as we're charting new territory here, which is a good thing. So this is sort of an inartful dodge, but I think this is a perfect example of something where, frankly, the work of outsiders who are thinking about this 24/7 can be hugely helpful to us and helpful to folks on the Hill who are our partners in this effort. So actually, one of these guys back here was on the right, I guess, my left.
My name is Serge Thomas, and thank you for speaking to us today, Mr. Chollet. I'll try and keep this brief. I had to write this down because of my tendency for rambling.
That's all right.
Given this question deals with the rise of China as a financial and powerful trade partner, perhaps the principal trade partner that this country has, given the PRC's a state-driven capitalistic system, becoming politicized over the last 6 to 7 years with the presidency of Hu Jintao and the premiership of Wen Jianbiao, how will the U.S. government regard China's institutional and financial disinclination to modify, if not reform, its practices in areas of trade and global finance? And what I'm referring to is when they had taken over after the retirement of Jiang Zemin, who's still within the government, but
right.
In the shadows, there was a move on the part of the leadership to pump money into their state system, mainly in banking and finance, and it's become localized. And there seems to be a calculation on the part of Beijing to not really make a lot of changes because they don't feel that they have to. And how will the United States just respond to that challenge of what is now basically a neo-mercantilist system that's a reality within global finance and even politics? Thank you.
It's a good question. The words "I don't know" come to mind, but the somewhat serious answer is going to be, I mean, I mentioned the strategic and economic dialogue that this administration is embarking on with China, and the very purpose of this kind of framework is to have a discussion on issues like that. I mean, and that's why what's different about, say, what the Obama administration is doing it, how it's doing it versus, say, the Bush administration is that it's Secretary Clinton and Geithner together working it, whereas in the previous administration it was just Secretary Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, who was sort of in charge of the strategic economic dialogue. This is the strategic and economic dialogue. But the part of the point is to have a forum in which those sorts of discussions can be on the table. And whether it's done in the open or privately, that's what we're trying to get at. It's not just to sort of take care of the issues that are right here in front of us, but the bigger picture, long-term issues that, again, are not going to be solved in the course of one meeting or one sort of discussion, but things that we've got to work on over time. And so the tricky bilateral issues, like you've mentioned, but also the larger sort of global strategic issues, whether it concerns the global economy or global security. So whereas I don't know the answer to your question specifically, I can say that it's certainly a perfect example of something that will be could be dealt with, I should say. I don't want to speak of the Treasury guys, that will be dealt with in the forum like we've created. So we can ask me in 4 years and maybe we'll have a better answer. Yes, ma'am. You.
Thank you very much. I'm Orion Kwong from Center for Diplomacy and Democracy. It's good to hear that you're saying during the past few months, the State Department is thinking about the strategy toward rising powers such as China, India. Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether the State Department is ready to share with us what kind of status we are or what kind of role we see China as. Back in 2007, I think I was the briefing at State Department. I think the Bush administration at that time defined the relationship, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I am, as strategic partner or something, no longer as a rivalry or enemy. So, and on top of that, I know this administration is moving toward engagement with a lot of countries, obviously with countries such as Afghanistan and Pakistan. But how about China, who in the public policy debating circle, we do see China as a rivalry or a competitor. But what kind of engagement policy, is there an engagement policy toward China at this stage? If there is, what kind of focus would that be? Thank you.
Well, I guess, I mean, engagement policy sort of connotes that you either have a choice. You either engage or work with them, or you just kind of do your best to ignore and move on. And I think there's a certain reality that, I mean, as the previous question alluded to, there's an economic reality of the kind of intertwined economies that we have, where we have this sort of almost mutually assured destruction relationship, as I've heard it described, between they're holding our debt and what we could do about it. And I think that there's a sense that China is an important global player increasingly. I mean, not just on economic issues or regional issues, but on global climate change. I mean, we're not going to improve the climate without something with China. I mean, you can't do it. And I think it's just, again, going back, this mechanism that we've set up with China is a recognition that the two countries have a lot to talk about, right? Doesn't mean we're going to agree on everything. In fact, we may disagree on a whole lot of things. But what we need is a sort of a way to work through those disagreements and try to find common ground where we can. I mean, I'm personally under no illusions about, whether or not this is going to be easy or not. And I think also it's out there that some scholars here in Washington, around the world, have talked about a G2. You know, that's not what we're looking for. That's not what we believe is the right thing to do in terms of the United States. You know, I think there are many global powers. I think India is certainly a global power. I think some of our traditional allies are global power. I think Brazil could be increasingly a global power. We just can't solve things alone. We just can't solve certain global issues with just one other country. But that said, I don't think, even though we understand we have to work with China on certain issues, there's an understanding that, or there's a sense that we're not going to agree on everything. And our challenge is to sort of work our way through that. I'm not going to remember it precisely, so go look it up. But I know that when President Hu Jintao and Obama met in London about 2 months ago now, they, in their joint statement, they came up with a sort of a mantra about what we're trying to achieve with China. And it's, I forget the words, but it's three, you know, it's harmonious something, something. It's very memorable, as you can tell, as a bumper sticker. But I think it generally captures what we are aspiring to. So I just don't think it's as simple as engage or disengage. I think there's a sense on a North Korea, for example, we very much need to work with China on North Korea. And in fact, part of, I think, what the United States believes is that China has a role that they really should play regarding the North Korea nuclear weapon threat. And part of what we're trying to do is work with them so they play that role. Because, again, that's not something we're going to be able to solve on our own. I'm sorry? I don't know that maybe someone here knows. If the last administration called them a strategic partner, I don't remember what. Do you remember what it was? No? You're just asking a question. All right. Oh, that's a Google thing. Somebody on their iPhone can figure it out right, and before the end of this. Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm Tamerlan Wahabov from Georgetown University SFS. You mentioned among the priorities of current administration the ungoverned territories.
Yeah.
I want to ask about the ungoverned territories in the former Soviet space, mm-hmm. be it Moldova, Transnistria, Georgia, in Abkhazia and Ossetia, or Armenian and Azerbaijani mm-hmm. conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh. So everybody in that area...
They're kind of governed, but they're not...
Ungoverned.
But they're sort of governed.
Yeah,
they're not...
Kind of, let's say
just not
the
in
conflict there.
Internationally recognized governance,
yeah,
I guess.
Maybe, yeah. Like, yeah. Let's say not governed by the sovereign.
I gotcha.
Every player there, be it Russia or the Qatar that I mentioned, have their own vision of the security around those conflict areas, let's say. So what is the niche? What is the niche for the United States to engage that, if given the dissimilarities between all those players there in the region? So what could be the, in your opinion, the niche for the United States to be more active there or to say to apply its so-called smart power there, let's say, if you will?
Well... each situation is different. There's no kind of one size fits all, you know, generic answer to the role, whether it's in Moldova or Georgia, that I think you could say. I mean, Georgia is an example where, you know, we do not recognize the independence of the breakaway regions. You know, just today, actually, the deputy secretary is meeting with the Georgian foreign minister because the secretary's out with her elbow injury. So I think, you know, part of what our role to play is to remain deeply engaged with the sovereign government and with, you know, in one case, Russia, to try to kind of find some bridging of the gap there. But there's no, you know, single sort of silver bullet answer to how we're going to solve those problems. When I was thinking of ungoverned spaces, I was more thinking of, the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region, which are truly, they're governed, there's no kind of even rump government in those places, unlike, say, in Abkhazia or in Ossetia. It's, you know, places that have limited, Pakistani government has limited control over the territory, and no one really does. And it's that sort of area of the world where, and you see it a little bit, say, even in Somalia or in Yemen to a certain extent, where a lot of the kind of the transnational threats, security threats emanate from. But I think that, you know, as we've been dealing with the aftermath of the sort of collapse of the Soviet Empire in that part of the world, in Georgia, in the Caucasus, as well as in East Central Europe for quite some time, and sort of still, and the sorting out that is going on there still, you know, almost 20 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So, you know, this administration's committed to remain very diplomatically engaged in that part of the world. We've already, you know, our assistant secretary for Europe has already been, you know, she was a couple weeks on the job and already did a tour around that region, deeply involved in the Nagorno-Karabakh negotiations. So I think, you know, it's I don't really have any sort of headline answer other than we understand the importance of the issue and we're certainly engaged on that. So. Yeah, you right there. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Ben with Schneidman Associates International. Secretary Clinton recently had a post, actually an article in the Huffington Post on food security, mm-hmm. which I think is going to become a mm-hmm. More increasingly important role. And noticeably absent from it, from her, I think, seven recommendations, was any mention of removing domestic subsidies on agriculture and then also removing tariff barriers for international agriculture. It's obviously the third rail of politics. Mm-hmm. Economists agree that it should be removed. I think most international analysts agree it should be removed. The only reason that we don't do it seems to be a lack of courage. Yeah. Will this administration have the courage to remove this atrocious, preposterous policy? Thank you.
So I'm going to dodge.
You can dodge.
Just going to lay it out there. I'm not going to pretend anything otherwise. Having done a few presidential campaigns over the last few years, I'm well aware of the issue, particularly in Democratic primaries. Not getting at that specific issue, but generally on the food security question, I think, you know, it's an example of a particular issue which is real time, and then also I think increasingly knowledge over the horizon. The secretary and the president really sort of understand and are kind of getting their hooks into that. Her post was evidence of that. And I think there's more to come on that issue, which is maybe a roundabout way of getting to somewhat of an answer, which is, you know, there's hard choices that have to be made. And I think, you know, where my knowledge, and I'm not in the food security lane, so to speak, within our government, but, you know, this is an issue that's being really, I mean, it's not the plan, the strategy is being developed as we speak. I think, you know, all these issues are going to be considered in due course. So, you know, what she wrote about a few months into office on the Huffington Post is not necessarily the end product of what we're going to do. But I think what you can take from that, and what you can take from what she said quite a bit about food security just in the time she's been in office and what she's been doing on her travels overseas, is a sign of the deep commitment to the issue. And it comes from the top. It's not just a sort of a kind of a one-off thing. This is something she, I think, is committed, and I know she's committed to showing some real results on. So stay tuned. Yeah, over there, yeah.
So I'd like to talk about, my name's Samuel Balbrow, I'm here at CSIS, a deft dodge right there, and why you have to do it. What we're really talking about here is a collective action problem. We've got people in the states who happen to vote early, and they are these farmers, and the American romanticization of how much they really do for our society, and all of this rhetoric that we're spewing back and forth at each other. But if we're really going to talk about what next America means, isn't the real collective action problem these young people here who have all these ideas, who have intelligent economic analyses of these real problems, but we have this fascinating forum speaking to someone in the place of power. We're actually saying these important things, but you have to dodge the questions because you can't go out and say, I'm sure there's a huge part of you that just wants to.
Because I clearly don't have enough power.
Oh,
if I had more, maybe I'd.
Well,
be
exactly.
Like,
so you know, let's if Secretary Clinton was here, she'd be giving us the same type of rhetoric because that's what she has to do. If we're going to have a collective action, overcome this collection action problem and actually have a good policy discourse, what is it that you recommend for us young people to do? In a situation where you can't always say your mind, because if you piss off the wrong person, then you don't get to go from an internship to a Schedule C.
Fair. I mean, it's. Part of the answer is, in terms of the dodge, it'll just be. I know it's because it's a very good question. I don't know the answer, right? So what I'm trying to do is navigate, you know, not stepping in it versus, it's giving you something thoughtful. But I think you actually kind of helped make the point that I made at the outset, which is, you know, it's not as though, you know, one side's on the right of, you know, light and happiness and the other side are evil, you know, craven farmers, right? There's a lot of interest at stake. Welcome to democracy, right? Where you've got people who are well-meaning, who believe deeply in their ideas, who are able to use their positions of influence because they were either elected to do it by their people or they were appointed to do it or they've just survived in government long enough that they moved up the food chain eventually, just doing what they think is best, right? So, but on an issue like whether it's food security or whether it's a nuclear weapons-free world or whether it's, you know, whether we should increase the budget for foreign assistance or not, there are really strong interests on all sides of these issues, and what's required is just a very thoughtful, healthy, vibrant debate. And, if I wish that there are a lot of easy answers to all this, although if there were easy answers, then there would be no purpose for think tanks, right? We are, you know, a lot of people in government, because it'd just be all so simple that you could just do it. So, you know, I think the more that there are people of your generation and below or above engaged on all these questions, the better. I mean, that's the beauty. That's why I frankly have a lot of confidence in the United States and its future as a power. I mean, there's sort of the fashion right now is to talk about post-American world or the rise of the rest and all that kind of stuff, as though things are changing and we're just kind of on the wrong side of things, because it's some of the decisions we've made, whether it's, you know, where we are around the world in terms of Iraq or Afghanistan or the state of our economy. But actually, the way I see the world kind of evolving is it plays to a lot of our strengths, and that what's going to require to succeed in the world is to be agile, to be creative, to be innovative, to be willing to sort of take risks. And I measure us, the United States, up against most other countries in that department. And I think, you know, the fact that we have that, again, not to just sort of blow smoke in this organization's direction, but, you know, the idea that there is an organization like this where young people can be engaged and can feel like they can make a difference and can ask tough questions and can, you know, push back when the questions get dodged and can come up with interesting ideas and, you know, write about it, whether it's something that's published by where you work or published in the newspaper. I mean, that's part of what makes us great and makes us extremely innovative. My colleagues from, you know, around the world who are sort of my peer group, you know, are envious that in the United States we have such a system of in and outers, you know, where people can leave government and come to a place like this and really, you know, get interesting ideas and then go into government and try to apply those ideas, or get very frustrated in trying to apply them. So that's, you know, I embrace it. Yes, in the orange, yeah.
Hi, my name is James. I'm not
getting it.
Thanks a lot for coming to speak to us today. I just had a question. You talked about bureaucratic reform kind of in the relationship between DOD and state.
Right.
And you also touched on development a little bit. So I was really curious to see, you know, there have been bureaucratic changes in terms of, you know, the start of the Millennium Challenge Corporation. And then USAID, there have been rumors for years about, you know, where it's going to go in terms of its relationship with state.
Yeah.
And then also recently there have been talks about maybe the creation of a department-level organization like the UK or some Scandinavian countries have. Mm-hmm. So I just wondered if you could talk about that, maybe where you see a state going in the future with the bureaucracy of development and where we might go. Thanks.
That's a great question, and that's another issue where before I joined government, I was a project I was involved in at Brookings. I did a lot of work on those issues from the outside, so now on the inside I've been seeing how either that was people paid attention to it or not. But it's certainly a lot of the ideas came, I mean, particularly as you mentioned, this sort of Department of Development idea was out there a lot, talked about quite a bit by experts on the outside. I mean, all I can say now is it's something where at state, you nailed it, where it's very much all these questions of sort of how we strengthen development are very much on the floor right now for discussion and debate internally. And you know, the secretary has made very clear, she made very clear the first time she walked into the State Department on her first day in office, said she's absolutely committed to strengthening diplomacy and development, and she's committed to having development be seen both externally and internally as on par with diplomacy in terms of the strength of the stool of American power. And one of the first things she did, which is a personnel move, but it's again hard to sort of state how important it is by creating a second deputy as deputy secretary. And so she's named Jack Liu, who is our deputy secretary for management and resources. And he's a former OMB director under President Clinton, so he knows his way around the federal budget and bureaucracy in Capitol Hill better than just about anybody walking the street. And it's you know, paid dividends just in terms of the knowledge and the skill set that he brings and the people around him that he brings to that set of questions. And he's tackling these very issues. And, you know, we're seeing this play out a bit in real time right now in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where part of the president's new strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan is to reform and make larger the civilian footprint on the ground, particularly in Afghanistan. There was a long article in the Post, I think, last Friday, that detailed in depressing specificity, the sort of the dysfunctionality of AID's work on the ground in Afghanistan over the past few years. And that's these issues are things that we're very familiar with and are working to fix. So no decisions have been made in terms of the, you know, exactly how we're going to be doing some of this, but it's all being, you know, it's occupying a tremendous amount of time and energy at the highest levels. And I think one of the pieces of good news is you've got commitment from on high to really institute reform. So I hate to keep saying watch this space, but it has only been like 5 months of the administration. So, you know, okay, I got time for one more, and then I got to go. You and yep.
I'm Parker Hicks with the Air Force, and I wanted to ask you about that increased civilian footprint in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Recently, the Center for New American Security's Andrew Exum published a paper on what he thought should happen there.
Yep.
One thing he suggested was putting that increased civilian footprint at the ministerial level as opposed to down on the tactical level working with the citizens of Afghanistan.
Uh-huh.
He got some criticism for that, a lot of arguments on both sides. Which way is state leaning right now?
When I left CSIS, I went to CNAS. Mm-hmm. So I have to say everything they did do is brilliant. No, the Exum got there after I left. So, I think we may be talking about two different things. I mean, my understanding—I did not read Exum's piece, but I had heard about it—is that he's talking about civilian capacity, the Afghan government civilian capacity, right, versus our civilian capacity.
When he spoke at the conference,
yeah. He
spoke on putting our people in the ministries to root out corruption, as opposed to putting them in PRTs dealing direct aid to the Afghan citizens.
I see. I think right now, there's a recognition that the Afghan government capacity, whether it's just its ability to do things when it wants to do it or the level of corruption inside the government, isn't what we want it to be, right? So, I think we're looking very closely at how we go about trying to improve that. But I think there's also a recognition that, you know, a lot of what we need to accomplish in terms of implementing the civilian side, so to speak, of counterinsurgency, is to protect the population in the field, not just in Kabul, but around the country. So there's an increased focus to bolster our diplomatic presence and civilian presence, both in Kabul and around the country, to, you know, better affect change on the ground throughout the country, not just at the ministerial level. Although, you know, so I think sort of the idea of embedding advisors in the ministries is not something we're necessarily seeking to do. I wouldn't necessarily rule it out at this point, but we're looking at other ways to try to address the same problem, because there's a recognition of what he's identifying as an issue is certainly an issue. Anyway, thanks everybody for your time. I appreciate it. Stay in touch. Yeah.
Well, obviously we're a spirited debate today. This is great. We're going to transition now into a roundtable discussion with some of our Next America fellows who are going to help us dive into the debates that we've started already today and also online, and hopefully continue that discussion with all of you here. Over the last several months, we've held debates on issues such as smart power, economic integration, human rights and development, defense and security, and energy and climate. Not an entirely exhaustive list, but we hopefully started a conversation. Today, we'd like to hear from our Next America Fellows to discuss some of the tough questions that we raised. Questions such as, how best should the U.S. compete in the global marketplace? How should we respond to China's role as a regional and global power? Is energy independence a myth? Next America has learned quite a bit about what millennials think, but also how we think. These millennials are pragmatic. They're consensus-driven, and they're not bound by traditional partisan debates. Admittedly, Next America members are a unique group of individuals. We have a deep interest in foreign policy and a commitment to addressing the critical challenges. Our social networks are online and global. For many of us, our worldview is shaped by the events of 9/11. Mostly 20-somethings, we come from different sectors and represent the full political spectrum. Yet, as a group, we agreed on quite a bit. At times, it was actually difficult to strike a debate. Members tended to agree on large principles, such as not scaling back foreign assistance, but debated the merits of how to do aid more effectively. On a few issues, such as defining success in Iraq, traditional divides remain. Youth and idealism often go hand in hand, But throughout our debates, these millennials proved to be pragmatic and demonstrated an understanding of how really complex and interconnected our world has become. We see the challenges we face as global and believe that the U.S. has a responsibility to lead. America's image abroad does matter. And for this group, credibility depends on the ability of the United States to blend principle and pragmatism into effective policy. These debates are only a starting point. Today, we would like to continue this discussion with all of you here. To do so, I'd like to introduce Josh Marcuse, who will moderate a discussion with our fellows. Josh is the founder and president of Young Professionals in Foreign Policy and is well known to many of us here as a rising star in his own right. Josh, in his tenure as head of YPFB, Josh has expanded that network beyond D.C. to Brussels, London, and New York, and has really created... Welcome. Join our debate. Has really created a pillar in Washington for fostering the next generation of foreign policy and otherwise leadership. Josh also works as a senior consultant at Booz Allen Hamilton, supporting clients in the Office of Secretary of Defense. Josh serves as a Next America Fellow and member of our advisory board, and we are grateful for his support. Please join me in welcoming Josh Marcuse to the panel, as well as the rest of our young professionals.
So I was burnishing my young professional credentials at my college reunion this weekend, and I appear to have lost my voice. So you please bear with me. is the microphone working? You gotta switch your mics on. So anyway, thank you for your patience. The Next America Project is an extraordinary project. It's a tremendous investment on the part of CSIS and young people, and it's been wonderful to be a part of it. And one of the things that we've been doing in the last few weeks is we've been reading what all of you wrote, and we've been looking carefully about what young professionals were saying. And one of the things that we found that was really interesting is that, you know, there's things that you can infer about what are the issues that young professionals care the most about based on what they said. And we saw that, you know, you can measure people's concern about the issues based on the volume that they wrote. We had 43 pages on defense and 10 pages on economic integration. Largely because I think economic integration is so complicated, only people like Ali can really help with it. But we looked at these issues, and one of the things that is really striking is that the issues are two things. They're both the things that are filling the inboxes of men like Derek Chollet that are the central challenges that we're facing on a daily basis, worried about what's going on today in Iran, worried about what's been going on the last month in North Korea, and they're things that are current now. But they are also the systemic fundamental problems that all of us in this room are going to be facing over the course of our careers. They're generational challenges. They're things that are befitting for us as millennials to take up because, indeed, we will be coping with them until we retire. So Next America has been amazing at getting at both that range of issues. And today, we're going to talk about all those things. And I'm really very pleased because surrounding me there's a group of young people on stage, Next America Fellows, who really can help us think clearly about these problems. I want to talk about the issues and not about them, but I have to tell you a few things about them because they're quite extraordinary among us. They have started not one, but you know, three or four nonprofits or journals. They have worked on the Hill for both Republicans and Democrats. They've worked in the executive branch. They've worked at a number of the think tanks in Washington, both left and right, many of them here at CSIS for the Global Strategy Institute, you'll be hearing from later. They have won numerous awards and accolades. They are truly an extraordinary group of people who have distinguished themselves again and again. So it's a great privilege for me to be sitting here among them. Laura Keating, immediately to my left, recently graduated from SEPA at Columbia. She worked here for 5 years at CSIS. She specifically focused on water issues. She's going to be talking to us about energy and the environment, something that figured very prominently in the debates over the last year, and talking to us about what she's done about innovation, about climate change, not climate change specifically, but about energy policy and what we need to do to face the immense energy challenges we have. Alex Toma works at the Plowshares Fund. Mr. Chollet mentioned the Prague speech, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the zero nuclear weapons goal later today. The Plowshares Fund, and Alex in particular, was instrumental in some of the work during the campaigns and after that made that happen. Despite the fact that she's a young professional like the rest of us, she truly is one of the town's leading experts on nuclear proliferation and what we can do about that problem. Hillary is a friend of mine. She was at the reunion with me, but apparently her judgment is better than mine, not just on human rights issues and on development issues, but on personal issues as well. So you will be able to hear her speak. Hillary works for Vestergaard Franssen. Vestergaard Franssen is a Swiss private sector company that nevertheless is working on issues of clean water and protection against disease that is saving lives, but not doing it as an NGO or humanitarian organization. They're doing it as a company, and that's fascinating. That's something else we'll talk about later today. Liz introduced me much too generously, so we'll move on to my friend Rachel, who I've known for many years currently. Rachel is doing two extraordinary things. She is working to launch her own foreign policy think tank with a number of other people called the Foreign Policy Initiative, which is a great organization, and you should check out their website. But she also is running for office. Rachel is running for chairwoman of Young Republicans. She was, 2 years ago, I believe, voted and selected Young Republican Woman of the Year. And so she is truly an extraordinary person and a leader among young conservatives all the way across America. And Ali is a very prestigious junior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's coming from MIT, where he indeed started a journal at another organization. I believe it's called American Progress Forum.
Forum,
and is going to be talking about trade issues, and Rachel will be talking about smart power, which we will try to weave throughout the whole discussion. So any further ado, I want to start asking some tough questions. And Hillary reminds me that all of them will be speaking as Next America Fellows. They'll be speaking about their own views, but they won't be speaking about the organizations that they work for. And as you can see, when you do need to speak for an organization you work for, and that organization is the White House, it really does limit what you can say. There is nowhere for us to hide. We will not dodge any questions. We will give you straight answers, or if we don't know the answer, we'll throw it back to you, the audience, and ask you to participate in this dialogue. Is there anything else crucial that I missed?
Nope.
Great. Well, then, starting with you, Laura, talking about the issue of energy, which Derek spoke about quite a bit, in the dialogue that we had online, everyone agreed that energy was a huge problem, and everyone agreed that the solution was innovation. But innovating is actually hard to do. And so what I wanted to ask you about was, what do you think our generation of millennials is prepared to sacrifice to fuel that innovation, whether it's dollars spent on research and development, whether it was the proposal that we debated in Next America about raising the price of gasoline with taxes or other things? What is the cost that we should be prepared to bear to generate some of the solutions that people talked about?
I don't think that we view it as a sacrifice. I think we recognize the cost, and that very much came through in the debates. But we recognize that within our lifetime, we're going to see a change in the global climate. The temperature will rise regardless of what we do. It's just a question of how far. But we also recognize that within our lifetimes, which is really exciting, we're going to see this amazing transition occur away potentially from fossil fuels. It's the first time that that's happened since our great grandparents. You know, that we could see this massive of a shift in the fuel that drives our economy. And I don't think that we're seeing it as a sacrifice. It's really coming down to the choices that we make. It's where do we live? What kind of car do we drive? What consumption choices do we make? It's the difference between having a major house in a suburb far away where we're going to have to drive 45 minutes to work in a big car that's going to cost a lot to get to fuel, or it's going to be living in a more dense urban area where we can walk to work or take public transportation. And those kinds of choices, I think, came out very clearly in the debates, that those are the kinds of choices that we want to have, we want the options to make, and we want to be making in the right direction.
Let me press you a little bit further on that, on the consumption issue specifically. Our generation, more than any that has gone before us, has been pressing for individuals to take personal responsibility, whether it's driving a hybrid car or just using less stuff. But my concern is, can we really make a difference as individuals when we know that a single factory can outpollute what this entire room full of people could potentially save? Or, you know, there are many things we can do here in America, but we know that China doesn't share the urgency that we do on these issues. And, you know, everyone in America could be virtuous and drive hybrid cars, but, you know, China is producing whole cities the size of Manhattan every year. So You know, does it really matter what individuals do to reduce consumption? Is it possible to take personal responsibility for this by buying a carbon offset?
I think you hit on two really key issues. One is the role the personal choice and reduction in energy consumption plays in the overall transition that we hope will occur in the next 50 years or so. And if you look at, there's a graph in most of these reports and things that talk about project the next 30 to 50 years of energy consumption and greenhouse gas emissions. There's a graph that kind of shows the projections, and it shows the business as usual scenario, and then it shows a bunch of different options and a bunch of different solutions that can be applied to this problem. And people call it the rainbow graph because it's all these little teeny slivers that are all different kinds of colors. And energy efficiency and improving energy efficiency is a big chunk in there. And so individual choices, and that improving energy efficiency essentially comes down to improving individual choices. Policy can drive that. You know, there can be incentives that can change people's, costs, or change the cost to individuals and then change people's consumption choices and that kind of thing. But it does make a difference. And I was amused to see, I haven't been back to CSIS in a while, but I was amused to see the eco products being used to the coffee cup for the coffee cups. And this one little cup, if we all use it, will save 742,414 gallons of gasoline, enough to drive around the world 673 times. So that's just one example of one choice that you can make that will add up if enough people do it. To big and significant changes.
It was a very effective use of thank you very much, Laura. Alex, I want to turn to you and switch gears and talk about national security and defense. Now, we referenced the Prague speech earlier. Now, months before the president had even been elected, you actually wrote that formative debates. One of the formative debates on the Next America website, right. That was you.
I did not write the speech.
No, you didn't write the speech, but you wrote an argument on the debate on the Next America site where you essentially agreed with what the president later said, and you laid out the same case that he laid out later about why this country, which essentially invented and is the only thing to have used the nuclear weapon, and where the nuclear weapon has been the cornerstone of our security strategy, you say that it's time to get rid of them,
right.
And that we need to move towards global zero. And the more I thought about that, the more I thought it was just a great metaphor for the Next America discussion of defense and national security as a whole, because the nuclear weapon itself is a technology that was invented by our parents for yesterday's threat.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you, if you believe that nuclear weapons actually make us less safe today, because it's an old weapon for an old threat, then can you talk a little bit about what you think the new threats are and what you think our generation should be doing in place of nuclear weapons to protect us against those threats?
Right. I think what's important to also add to that is that when you add nuclear and terrorism, which is one of the biggest threats that we face today as a nation, then that gets pretty scary. And that's one of the – both McCain and Obama, when they were running – both said that that's the number one threat. In fact, if you remember the previous election, both Kerry and Bush also said that. That's the number one threat. And then it kind of got, blended away. But certainly nuclear terrorism. And in fact, in our debate online, that was one thing that we all agreed on, was that nuclear terrorism is the greatest threat to America today, bar none. So what can we do to keep ourselves safe we get rid of the nuclear weapons. As we know, nuclear weapons are not a deterrent to terrorists. So there's, that's kind of part of the argument. What can we do? Well, we can secure the weapons we have right now. a year ago, last summer, there were several nuclear warheads that were armed that went missing for 36 hours. Nobody knew that they were missing, and then nobody knew where they were. They were flying across the United States in a plane. It was the U.S. Air Force plane, granted, but nonetheless, that's pretty scary, So what do? We make sure we lock down the nuclear weapons that we have, secure the vulnerable. So it's another thing. Don't call it loose nuclear material. They're not sitting on the corner of 18th and K. they are insecure facilities, but we need to make sure that we have a count of where they all are and that they are secure, both here in the United States and abroad, which is one thing that that was actually disappointing about the Obama budget, was that there wasn't enough money to do that. And he says securing all loose nuclear materials, vulnerable materials, within 4 years. Well, then the budget came out, and oh, where's the money to do that? So luckily, the House Armed Services Committee just recently, last week, plussed up the budget to do that. So that's one of the big things that we can do is to secure the weapons that we do have and our allies.
Thank you so much, Alex. I want to talk a little bit more about that specific issue, mm-hmm. but coming at it from a different direction, which is, if you accept the premise that nuclear terrorism is the biggest threat that we face, I think you did a great job of explaining what we need to do to protect ourselves from the nuclear. But now I want to talk a bit about the terrorism issue and turn to Rachel. And specifically, one of the things that we talk a lot about in terms of counterterrorism is not just what specific intelligence or military operations we can conduct to combat terrorism, but addressing the root causes. And many people look to smart power and the principles that actually Rachel worked on when she was working on the Hill for Mac Thornberry. She was staffing him on the Smart Power Commission. So Rachel's experience with smart power goes way prior to Next America. What I wanted to ask Rachel about is, when we talk about smart power, we talk about trying to reduce the causes of terrorism, we run into a problem, which we have to ask ourselves about America's image and whether it's the policies or the packaging that is such an affront to the communities and the societies across the world that are fomenting the terrorism. So that's what I wanted to ask you about in specific, which is, you know, this is a president that we have that has really staked his credibility both during his campaign and as president on the value of public diplomacy, on the value of engagement. He's gone on an aggressive speaking tour around the world, and he is trying to frame himself as a more popular avatar for America. But my concern is that that's not really going to help. And so I wanted you to address that issue. Is it the policy of America, or can we frame the policy differently in ways that will do things like reduce terrorism?
Yeah, I like this language of packaging, because I think it really gets to the way that a lot of people view this debate, which is what we're doing marketing? Are we selling the brand of America? And this is something that America is clearly very good at, whether it's McDonald's or Hollywood. People buy America, American around the world. At the same time, we have, more fundamental than that, we have a country that stands for freedom and opportunity and people who want to come here, and mm-hmm. and we still yet do exist as this shining city on a hill. On the other hand, we're coming out of a time where we clearly had a very unpopular president in terms of global opinion and certainly some unpopular wars. And so as we look at packaging versus policy, I think it's important to realize that popularity is not the problem, right? That and Obama provides us a perfect case study for this. President Obama was elected clearly with a majority of American support, with a vast majority of support among our generations, winning by a 2-to-1 margin among under 30 voters. We saw in his speech in Berlin and also in Prague that he's clearly very popular in the world, certainly more popular than our previous president. The world didn't automatically become a big happy place when he was elected, and in fact we faced a lot of very serious challenges since he was elected that he's had some problems combating. You know, this very popular president hasn't had a huge amount of success convincing other countries to accept detainees from Guantanamo Bay. It's been interesting to watch how he's maneuvered the Iran situation, in my opinion, failing to really lead and get out front on the issue as a very popular leader of the world's only superpower. And so at the same time as popularity is not the problem, popularity is clearly not the solution. And I think it's important that we realize that in my mind, that's where the imperative of policy comes through, that really is what people are looking for, that whether it's protesters for the reform movement in the streets of Tehran, they're looking for a president who's not just going to be likable, but a president who's going to implement actual policies that drill down into policies that help advance America's interests and in fact, the interests of the world.
I think that's great. Building on that, about the importance of the U.S. policy affects others, I think one of the things that's contributed heavily to anti-American sentiment recently is that the financial crisis in America and our mortgage crisis rapidly spun out of control and quickly became almost overnight a global financial crisis. And so when we talk about economic integration, Ali, we're really understanding that it's not something that we can debate whether or not the economies are integrated. The globalization is happening and we can't stop it. So my question for you is about that issue. How do we address those concerns when the United States is driving an economy not always in the right direction? We depend on the global interconnectedness for our own prosperity, but at the same time, the very same benefits that we're seeing from trade and globalization is producing severe dislocations that are hurting both American citizens, but also people all over the world. And that really gets to the subsidies issue that we were debating so eloquently earlier. Our subsidies to support our farmers is directly hurting other people. What do you think we should be doing about that as a generation? What do you think the solutions are? And at the same time that we're worrying about the negative effects of globalization, how do we also remember to keep our eye on the American competitiveness ball and make sure that we're also doing what we need to preserve our own prosperity?
Well, this is actually one of the consensus points of the debate, was that globalization is here to stay. Interconnectedness is here to stay. And a lot of the debates that we're having right now about protectionism, you think back to the 1930s when these same debates were taking place, and we've seen what the consequences of implementing or going with, you know, carrying through with protectionist sentiment have been. So in some sense, we've already been down that road. We've seen what the consequences are. So it might seem like a bit of an evasion to say that I'm going to stay away from the trade issue, but trade is here to stay. The economy is becoming increasingly interconnected, and globalization really is the paradigm for understanding geopolitics today. So I would actually say, turning to the, you know, the question of global competitiveness, I think that the focus on trade is actually misplaced. Trade is here to stay, so what are alternatives, you know, alternative sources of American competitiveness? And I think that there are at least a few that come to mind, in addition to the ones that were mentioned in the debate. One is learning languages. It seems very basic to suggest that, but I was pulling up some statistics before I came here this afternoon. The 2000 census said that less than 10% of Americans speak another foreign language. In 2006, one of the members of the Secretary of Education's office said that of the students who are studying a foreign language in the United States, 70% of them are only speaking Spanish. And we really need to change that. Now, to the Bush administration's credit, in 2006, the Bush administration announced a national security language initiative that said, here are the priority languages we need to study. We need to study Chinese. We need to study Hindi. We need to study Farsi and Russian. But only 2% of Americans are speaking those languages. And at the same time, if you look on the flip side, by 2015, half of the world's population is going to be speaking English. So you look at that dynamic and you look at where Americans are in learning foreign languages. So traveling and learning foreign languages is key. Another thing is restoring research and research and innovation to their rightful place. In the second half of the 20th century, 50%, and that's a pretty staggering number, 50% of American growth can be directly attributed to scientific and technological innovation. So research and innovation are critically important, and we need to make it easier for students, for researchers from abroad to come here. I was pulling up some other statistics. Between 2005 and 2006, the number of graduate school applications to the United States increased by 12%, but that increase has been going down. It started off at 12%, then it went to 9%, then it went to 6%, and in this most recent year, the number of international applications to American graduate institutions only increased by 4%. So that's a very worrying trend. We need to make ease visa restrictions to bring students and researchers here. Going on those points, the last point that I would make in terms of how we can really stake out a competitive edge, Mr. Cholet was talking earlier about being really, really innovative and being at the cutting edge. One of the biggest ways that we can contribute is coordinating, serving a role as coordinating a lot of the efforts right now that are being undertaken to solve global challenges. Right now, one of the biggest problems we face, whether it's fighting climate change, whether it's fighting poverty, is that there's so many people, whether it's individuals, NGOs, governments, international organizations that are working on these issues, and there's no coordination. There's an overlapping of effort. There's redundancy. There's competition between these organizations that are undertaking these different efforts. So one of the major ways in which we can contribute and restore American leadership and competitiveness is to say, these are setting clear benchmarks for achieving progress on these global challenges and identifying, really laying out, here's what's being done, here's who's doing it, here are where synergies may occur, here's where redundancy is occurring, and really taking a lead on that front. Right now, what's going on, it's just too much chaos. So if the United States can serve a coordinating role kind of lifting us out of the chaos and saying, this is what needs to be done, this is who can do it best, and really leveraging those synergies and eliminating redundancy, that's something that isn't being done right now, and that's a huge way in which we can become competitive again.
That's a great example, and that makes me think of actually one of the other themes in the debate that came up in a different sector, and that was the tremendous emphasis on efficiency that millennials were looking to specifically with respect to development issues. And so one of the things is one of the questions that we put out that we thought was going to spark a lot of debate was, you know, what are the responsibilities of the United States to people suffering around the world, and should the United States increase its foreign assistance budget? Should it decrease its foreign assistance budget? And so we asked about increase or decrease, and everyone didn't answer that question. What they said was, what we want is a more efficient investment in foreign assistance. And there was tremendous concern about what was perceived as waste, which is exactly what you were talking about. The United States is perceived as doing many things. You know, President Bush's unprecedented commitment to solving AIDS in Africa, for example, and all that money spent on PEPFAR. But people are concerned the money's being wasted. I wanted to throw out to the audience and ask them the question, do you believe that we need to be overall just spending more money on foreign assistance? Do you think that given how much we're suffering at home with our financial crisis, now is not the time to be increasing that investment? Or do you share the view that so many of the people said when they posted on the site that really what we need is what Ali was talking about, which is a much more efficient investment? Yeah, please, at the microphone.
Hi, I'm Jenny Rothenberg from the U.S. Global Leadership Campaign, and we are a coalition of about 400 businesses and NGOs who work primarily to advocate for increasing funding for the international affairs budget. So for me, I would say it's both, that we want to increase funding overall for all of the programs while making sure that we have more efficiency and making sure the programs are being used correctly. I think that, you know, the Foreign Assistance Act of 1961 hasn't been revised since 1961. These things don't happen overnight. We need to keep investing for three major reasons: to protect, you know, our national security, because the international affairs budget is part of the national security picture, for economic prosperity here and abroad, and as you said, for moral leadership and restoring our image in the world. So I don't think it's the time to bury our head in the sand, and I think we all have to do more to educate our colleagues and the average citizen of how much of this money that we spend abroad comes back home.
So I don't know, the differing view? Yes, Vanessa. I think they're recording, actually, so that's why we're using the mics. Thank you.
Well, I don't disagree exactly, but I think that it's also important to, when we are providing aid to, like, for example, I focus on East Asia, that utilizing the regional setup and cooperation that already exists is vital to order to get some of the work off of our back, but also strengthen the ties that are already there, not be afraid to give our support to, like, ASEAN and ASEAN Plus 3, because although they have been given some uneven credit in the past, I think that they're definitely, Asia is a place that we could be looking to, that we already have positive ties, and that we can continue to foster ties. But just for statistics, in the past year, overall development money to Africa and to poor countries has decreased by 50%. So that's a huge chunk. The World Bank just put out a report on that. So obviously it's common in an overall trend for countries to become more protectionist in times of financial troubles, but obviously we need to come up with more of a global mechanism to ensure that these developing countries are not going to be just cut dry when we have issues here. So,
does anyone have a thought on the efficiency issue specifically?
Josh, before we, while he comes up, maybe can I just add one thing?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Why don't you come up and please?
Yeah, just quick fact. Correct me if I'm wrong, but if I remember, just the numbers, what we're talking about here is less than 0.1% is what we spend on the foreign affairs budget. So let's just put that in perspective here.
Yes.
So on efficiency, everyone I've talked to who has had actual, like, on the ground experience trying to help nations develop, taking that rare money that we give to into foreign investment, has told me that one of the most essential things of actually getting a nation to develop, to have sustainable development, is to have the people, civilians and government of that foreign nation, intrinsically involved in whatever project is being worked on. I mean, having them actively work to create like a power grid system or clean water system, whatever is being worked on. That gives them pride in what's being developed. If it's only us, if it's predominantly us who's building this, it's just charity. You have to develop that sense of nationalism, the sense of pride in what is being built, in what is being developed.
I think it's absolutely right, and that was one of the main themes that came up in the discussion. The millennials who were posting on the Next Marker site were saying that having that host nation buy-in and integrating the foreign assistance effort with their indigenous efforts was critical. One of the other things that really came up very prominently was what I noticed was a significant preoccupation with the notion of doing good and doing well at the same time as part of foreign assistance. And generally, I think millennials reject the notion that there's a trade-off between those things. And what they really want to see is a model of being able to seek out the efficiencies, again, from the private sector and to be able to have a net gain, both economically as well as to be addressing the problems of global health or poverty, those issues. And so I wanted to turn it back to Hillary because her company is really emblematic of that approach. It's a private sector company, but they are providing drugs for malarials or the mosquito nets, actually, and life straw, which is fascinating, for clean water. And so as someone who's both worked on the ground in these countries, doing that kind of work that we're talking about, working for a private company to do truly public goods, I think there's something we can bring the efficiency of the free market and the morality of the humanitarian impulse together to try to benefit everyone. What are your thoughts on that issue?
Well, I could not agree with you more, Josh. It's much of what we sell is donor-funded. However, there are plenty of private sector organizations that are kind of coming together around the need to really invest in people, whether that be oil companies in creating clinics for their employees, whether that be, you know, a pharmaceutical company having a division that creates drugs for neglected tropical diseases, whether it be social enterprise organizations like Ashoka, Acumen, Common Capital, which is kind of a venture humanitarian organization. My organization, whose mission is profit with a purpose, so we develop products specifically targeted to the bottom of the pyramid and create retail establishments, which helps with economic development, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa, but also Southeast Asia, Latin America, et cetera. So there really is something to be said about bringing kind of the best of both worlds together. And our understanding, I think, of having grown up post 9/11 that has kind of shattered some of the concepts that we had about security and about, you know, being isolationist, and even the idea of there is black and white, that there is business and there is nonprofit. I think many of us really exist in the shades of gray and understand that we need all partners involved. And I also want to really emphasize there's no silver bullet. As mentioned earlier, if any of these issues like global poverty and health epidemics were easy to solve, there wouldn't be people like me who are employed and donors that are giving millions of dollars every year to these causes to stem some of these issues that I think many of us see as not just them. There's an interconnectedness that I really do feel that our generation understands. I feel that it's important to really kind of carry on this mission that so many of these organizations with our forebears have kind of created and work tirelessly with the foreign aid modernization, for example, figure out how partnerships can work together both at kind of the headquarter U.S. government D.C. level, but also in the field and on the ground. And this huge debate about, okay, should defense really be doing humanitarian aid programs? What does that do for the security of nonprofit workers on the ground? Are they going to be seen as, infiltrating areas that perhaps the U.S. government has a security interest, and does that put them in harm's way? Or, is it worth it because the synergies in terms of the cost saving really make more sense economically, especially when we're thinking about how we can save money, et cetera? So it's a fascinating intersection, and I agree that it's certainly an area that we all need to kind of push forward and start to figure out a little better how to scale that up.
Hillary, as soon as you started talking about the overlaps between defense and assistance and development, you made it impossible for me to pass that up. I'm going to have to address that issue specifically. And I'm going to ask you to weigh in on this as well, Rachel. One of the things that's come up when we talk about the efficiency of the foreign assistance investment, and we also talked about the interagency process and coordinating and these issues, is we want to be able to use our development assistance strategically. We want to be able to use our aid to foreign countries to address some of those root causes of terrorism that Alex or Rachel were talking about, and we want to be thoughtful about how we're trying to accomplish as many different types of objectives as possible. And that is how we got ourselves in the situation where you did have the military providing the kind of assistance in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, in dangerous places, and in other parts of the world as well, that normally wouldn't have been the province of the department. But the problem with doing that, as you said, is that the Department of Defense doesn't necessarily have the comparative advantage there. So we're in a situation where we're trying to do a lot of different things and be efficient, but we can't tell if it's smart power or if it's just dumb economics. And so I wanted to ask you about that issue specifically, recognizing that we get back to the civilian capacity issue and the civilian capacity issue to do development. Because if you really take seriously your own comment, the Department of Defense ought not be in these places, and it should be groups like USAID or NGOs, then that means you're going to have to put those groups in harm's way in places where they'd be shot at. Do you think that's the direction we need to take?
Well, I posed this question recently to Admiral Zimmer, who's the director of the President's Malaria Initiative, specifically about conflict zones that are malaria endemic. Who should be playing the role there, you know, especially if we have military on the ground? So I'm going to steer clear a little bit more from the Middle East, because that's not where I do the majority of my work. But what he said is that, of course, part of the pullout strategy is to ensure that when you leave, you have a sustainable infrastructure that truly can kind of carry on. And, you know, when people are asked, what is it that will make you happy and not, you know, resort to difficult kind of violent situations and groups and mechanisms, very often it's, you know, education for my children and healthcare. We want to be assured that, you know, if we break a leg, it's going to be fixed. Or, you know, if I get HIV, I'm going to have the drugs that the rest of the world has. So in places that are kind of war-torn, post-conflict, where military operations have been and are pulling out, it makes perfect sense for kind of the transition phase for the Department of Defense really to have a key role in that. And it's especially wonderful because so much of development and foreign aid assistance is logistics. And there's really no one better probably in the world than the U.S. government and our military operations that are able to really go in there and take charge and get the things where they need to go, source the people who know how to do it, and, you know, especially if it's large infrastructure programs, which, of course, in many of these post-conflict areas are the main priority. But then, of course, as you start to progress further down kind of time, it's really important to make sure that there is a clear distinction between, you know, this is a U.S. government kind of war situation where this is our security interest versus we're doing this for our security interest, but it's only because we want you to be safe and we don't want you to, you know, join terrorist organizations and we don't want you to be unhappy and unhealthy.
As promised, Rachel, what's the smart power angle on that? Do you agree with her view about the sort of, one would hope, seamless transition from military operations to doing more sort of more altruistic-focused development? How do you think that balance should fit?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, kudos to the United States for military for actually standing up and doing the job when no one in the United States government, aside from the DOD, appears to be doing that effectively. At the same time, soldiers are being put in these positions, whether it's, you know, building sewage systems or passing out soccer balls, where they're outside of what we might think of what it means to be a soldier, and I think that's rooted in the fact that the battlefields of today are simply different than the battlefields of yesterday. That we're, as has been alluded to several times, we're not just fighting wars with guns and tanks. We're fighting ideological battles on the streets, trying to make it not worth a young Iraqi's if he values $10 to go kill an American soldier more than his own life, then we're fighting an ideological battle. And so I think I like this idea of the transition piece that that as the United States military sort of fights and wins more traditional battles, that USAID and the State Department development and diplomacy need to come in and fill those gaps. I think we touch here upon a very serious problem with the reliance upon contractors at USAID, that we're outsourcing a lot of those jobs to people not specifically sort of within the United States government. And I think the good news is that we have a launching off point now with this smart power idea, whether it's obviously Hillary Clinton's use of the smart power idea in her testimony for her Secretary of State hearings, but also prior to Secretary Clinton and prior to President Obama, Secretaries Gates and Rice writing a joint op-ed in the Washington Post on just this idea that we need to step up civilian capacity, that we need to be able to deploy our State Department and our Agriculture Department and our experts in the Commerce Department to teach people how to you know, farm and build business as we do the other jobs. So there's bipartisan consensus, and I think that provides a really good launching off point as we think about how to solve that problem together.
It would not be fair not to give Alex a chance to weigh in on that very defense-focused question. We've often heard that the mistake made by departments of defense, historically, internationally, is we always prepare to fight the last war. So, and then we don't know what the threat we face is, and so we may have prepared to fight the last war and we find ourselves in yet a new kind of war. And so the debate that's raging in the Pentagon now where I work is, should we be training our military in the future to be handing out soccer balls, standing up town councils, and doing those sorts of things, at least until they can hand it over to what we hope will one day become a more robust civilian capacity? Or ought we be saying that that is actually not the purpose of the military? As they often say, you know, we're there to kill people and break things. You should trust us with those original purposes we were intended. Do you think that the U.S. military should be preparing for more Iraq, more Afghanistan, maybe prepared to have to do a Pakistan if necessary, and thinking about how to do those small-scale, very counterinsurgency-focused missions that blend into development and are like that way? Or do you think we need to be going in a different direction, one where we continue to focus on high-end, high-tech operations against perhaps a China or a threat like that at the high end of the spectrum? Where do you think the military should be going over the course of our lifetime?
Why not both?
Fiscal constraints would be both, because that'll be a question for Ali. That's why.
let's talk about that. With the foreign affairs budget being less than 0.1% and the defense budget being I used to cover this on the Hill. I don't remember what it is. It's gigantic. Can we not allot some of that budget towards more sort of creative missions versus having more? You know, maybe a majority of the budget towards the sort of, not the past wars. You know, obviously we're not going to be fighting the Soviets. We're not doing trench warfare anymore, obviously. But then again, investing in technology, obviously that's not going to work either. I think it is going to be, maybe not hand-to-hand combat, but it is going to be the terrorist. It's not going to be the outfitted, army guy on the other side of the line. It's an interesting question. I have mixed feelings about this. I think what will be interesting is to see what happens in AFRICOM, which is is very debatable. Again, sort of, I think there's that would have been a very interesting debate to have. But that will, I think, certainly mix the two. So let's see what happens with that. That's starting up now. They're in Stuttgart now, but hopefully soon they'll be, moving headquarters in Africa. And I think we'll see what happens with that. Does it work? How will it work? Are we making up the sort of scariness that we think, what if we have the Defense Department doing some development work? And I really like what you said. I would agree exactly with what Hillary just said. Or is it not that scary? Or will it work? So I think let's look at AFRICOM and I think try and, again, like it's not black, it's not white. Let's see. Maybe there is a way we can train the military to do both. And I think one thing that Ali said was great is putting money into language, into cross-cultural training, things like that. I think that needs to be done regardless of whether you're doing development or defense. So I think we're moving in the right direction, and I think AFRICOM will be a big stepping stone.
Absolutely. I want to ask the audience a variation of the same question. What do you all think ought to be the proper balance between these different elements of national power, whether it's the diplomacy and the development, or is it more the Department of Defense and the military power? Do you think that they should be kept separate? Do you think they should be more integrated? Do you think that the figure that Alex stated, that 0.1% needs to change and we should be substantially rebalancing the budget? Any opinions on this issue? Yes, please.
So I'm a little bit biased as I'm serving the Air Force right now. But I think if there was one lesson from 2003, it was that this isn't really a spectrum. It's not really, it's right now it's 75% defense and 25% development. It's all muddled together. And it's one of those things where sometimes it's impossible to separate them. And you've got, a soldier is literally going from a combat situation 1 second to handing out a candy bar the next. One of the lessons we learned from experience in the 40s and 50s in Malaya, I think, is that combining and unifying the command of the civilian agencies and the defenses is where there's going to be a lot of benefit. And AFRICOM is starting to do that, very, very broad integration. I think that's really the way to go because you can't say we're going to hand over responsibility because, frankly, there will be combat responsibilities, whether or not we have combat troops there in Iraq for the next 15, 20 years, quite potentially. So I don't think it's where we can say it's one person's, one department's responsibility versus the other. Really an integrated focus on what's going to be best for security in the region, because separating security and development, so often they go literally hand in hand the entire way.
Other thoughts on that? Yes, sir, in the back.
Hi, Owen Sanderson, CSIS. You can't separate diplomacy and development. You can't separate international policy. Literally, any part of foreign policy is all connected. There's no separation. There's no specific lens where you focus on one problem. Everything has a tit for tat, a this for that. And I think in regards to development in particular, we mentioned the 0.1%. We're still giving the largest in comparison to the rest of the world, billions of dollars. But still, I think that needs to go up. And I think the one aspect we can look at is that UN target mandate for 0.7%. We still need to get there. And so, like I said, when we go towards that mandate, that 0.7%, we need to look at the bigger picture, how everything is all connected, how foreign policy, if there's a great picture in The Economist this week that shows Obama, he's got his hand on his head, he's on the phone, and he's thinking about what to do in North Korea and Iran, two completely different parts of the world. I think we need to realize that when you look at foreign policy through a large lens, you can't just take one thing individually. It's all interconnected. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I know. Yes? Please.
Yeah. Hi. I'm Priscilla Chisholm. I'm antediluvial. I'm not a but I was involved at the Washington National Cathedral, as was Hillary, in a global summit to end poverty that was called by Madeleine Albright and Mary Robinson of Ireland and other phenomenal women around the world. And I would say that in terms of economy and being very effective in reaching out to the developing world, to empower them in respecting their culture, I can think of nothing more effective and cost-effective than microfinance. Mm-hmm. And I also think that to the degree that we frame these objectives in a military context, that's the most expensive way we could possibly try to have that kind of impact. And it also, a friend of mine is General Claudia Kennedy, who spoke at a conference in Germany with Madeleine Albright and others, and creating an end to poverty in a cost-effective way, people at that conference concluded would be perhaps the most high-impact thing we could do to create peace.
Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely true, and that's definitely reflected in the discussion. People of our age are very interested in microfinance, particularly in social entrepreneurship. But the question that leaves me with is, even if we decide that that is a terrific mechanism for investing precious taxpayer dollars to have in it, there are limits to what microfinance can achieve, and I wanted to talk to Ali about that. The concern I have is you can't use microfinance to address structural monetary and structural fiscal issues that have come across as a result of the crisis. Ironically, microfinance, if practiced properly in the United States, might have prevented people from defaulting on their loans. $15 billion at the right time might have prevented all this. But since we aren't perfect and we make these mistakes and these crises do happen, we need to have the right levers to address them. What do you think are the right levers for our generation to be using when microfinance fails?
Well, I think this actually ties back to the question of fiscal constraints. When you're in a situation of fiscal constraints, and especially constraints that are so deeply exacerbated in a situation like the global financial crisis, you go back to what works, things that have proven themselves to work. So I'll give an example. I was reading a discussion, or it was actually a debate the other day about all of the infectious diseases that are ravaging the developing world, and we have a limited budget. Which ones should the United States invest in combating? And the natural answer is HIV/AIDS, understandably. It's taken a toll, exacted a tremendous toll in the developing world. But the respondents said that there are many preventable diseases that kill millions and millions of people. The solutions are known. They can be deployed very easily at low cost, but they're not the fashionable diseases. And I know that sounds crude, but they're not the diseases that are in vogue. People don't care as much about malaria or diseases like that. They don't have the same resonance as something like an HIV/AIDS. But it's proven that we know that investing in at a very low cost, we can cure a lot of those diseases, and we can eradicate them from the planet at little cost and really, really empower the developing world. That's one example. Another example that we know works is promoting the greater exchange of students from going from the United States to other countries and other countries coming to the United States. One example that I find very distressing is that, my parents are from Pakistan originally, so I have a little bit of a personal interest in this issue, but I found out recently that the Fulbright program that sends students from the United States to Pakistan has been canceled for the past few years. And I think that that sends exactly the wrong message. We know that in a country like Pakistan, the last thing that they need is non-engagement. It's precisely because it's in a situation of crisis, whether it's in the Swat Valley, whether it's fighting the Taliban, whether it's extremism. It's precisely because it's in a situation of crisis that it needs American engagement, it needs global engagement. So restoring a program like the Fulbright in countries, strategic countries that are in situations of peril is another proven strategy. So what I would say is that even though we have limited resources, we do have constraints, there are things that we know work. There are strategies that throughout history, have worked. And I think that at very little cost, a lot of those can be leveraged. A lot of those same strategies can be employed. In terms of an overall paradigm, and then I'll end there, I think that the best thing that we can do is to realize that the situation we're in now, where you have a rising, employ the phrase, the rise of the rest, we do have a situation where there are many emerging powers in the world. The last thing that we want to do is posit a national interest. The United States has its own national interest, and the rest of the world, there's some kind of dichotomy. This was the lesson. This was actually the brilliant insight of Harry Truman. Harry Truman, when he was serving the global landscape, he said, there isn't that dichotomy. He rejected that dichotomy. It's false. And he said that the best way that the United States can lead and enhance its own power, whether it's soft power or hard power, is to help the rest of the world recover. And that's what the genius of the Marshall Plan was. That's what the genius of helping Asia rebuild in the aftermath of wartime devastation. Now, granted, we don't have a world war that's just taken place, but we have a global financial crisis. We have hundreds of millions of people, if not billions of people, who are clamoring to experience the trappings of democracy and freedom. And our goal is not to posit a false dichotomy between our interests and theirs, but is really to engage, to empower them. And I think that if we do that, that really helps us. And I think that when we talk about Next America, in terms of our generation and being pragmatic and being solution-oriented, really the best thing that we can do is to empower the rest of the world, and consequently we empower ourselves. And I think that's the way to lead.
I think that's great, Ali. I think one of the really brilliant insights that you had there was when we were talking about the different diseases that we combat, we often look at the problems that we most want to solve, mm-hmm. not the problems that are the most serious. Yeah. And so I wanted to to sort of wind down by focusing our attention on an issue that I think fits that description. And I've asked you a lot of questions, Laura, about energy. But I actually think that for our generation as millennials, there's another natural resource that we don't think about very much, that we often take for granted, that will, perhaps even more than oil, be a source of global conflict. And I wanted to ask you about water, something that's much less sexy to deal with than AIDS, but may actually have more to do with who lives and who dies, who is safe and healthy, and who is at risk. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the market and the competition for water and how this is going to shape our generation's foreign policy experience?
That's a big question. Yeah, I mean, we can talk about alternative energy. There's no alternative to water, you know. The water challenge, the international water challenge, can be broken down into a couple of parts. One is access. I'm a little bit rusty on these numbers because I've been focusing more on climate change and energy recently. But vast portions of the world, you know, majority of the world in the next 20 to 40 years are going to be living in water-scarce countries, mm-hmm. places that have, you know, less than, 1,100 meters per capita per year, cubic meters per capita per year per person. At that level, you know, you have to start making really tough choices about do you use your water to grow crops to feed your people, or do you use your water to power your to cool down your power generation facilities, or do you use your water for the silicon chips that are going to drive your economy? And so we're going to see this massive shift in the economy that's going to be, that will be predominantly driven by water availability in different countries. The second major pillar in international water challenges is a little bit closer to the malaria issue, and that's clean water, access to clean water. You know, we have 2.1 billion people right now that don't have access to sanitation facilities, you know, a basic latrine. They do not have any, I mean, just a basic pit latrine, they don't have it. 1.2 billion people don't have access to clean drinking water. Not lack of access means they have to walk more than a mile. They have to wait in line at a hand pump for more than an hour. And even if that water that they do have access to, in the event that it was treated at some point, they're going to have to carry it home in a vessel that is probably uncovered and will sit there on their dirt floor and will probably be contaminated by the time that they give it to their children to drink. And that is, you know, that is the basis for a lot of the other health issues that that we see. And so you can, it's one of those issues that is, you know, we've been talking a lot about integrating issues and integrating defense and development. I mean, water is one of those issues that is a defense and a development issue that is just interwoven into so many of these other issues. And it's not, because it touches all of these different issues, it's very rarely given to one person to really drive forward in our bureaucracy or in our policy sphere. And so it kind of falls through the cracks a lot. And so that's yet again adding to the threat that it could pose to future stability and security in the world.
Unfortunately, I think that is going to have to be the last comment as we draw this conversation to a close. I've observed in Washington that it's customary at the end of a dialogue like this to make a wisecrack about how we've solved all the problems and now we can go into the cocktail hour. But in this case, I feel like even joking about that is not appropriate. And that's because of the unique nature of the Next America project that Liz created. This is a conversation that began last July. Much has changed in the world and in this country since then. But we have this amazing website. The URL is right over there, where we can continue to have the kind of conversation we shared today online, as we've been doing for the last year. Next America will continue. All of these challenges will continue. All of our careers will continue. And so please, we hope. I don't know about mine. But but it's very important for us to stay focused on these issues. And I learned a great deal from everyone here. I hope you feel the same way. But please do go back to the site and take a look at it and participate in the discussion and carry forward this debate. We're very lucky to have a really deep and detailed analysis of the way the world will look coming up next. And so I'll turn the floor back over to Liz to introduce that to you, an amazing program. But before I do that, I do need to say one other thing, which is that all of us in the room and all of us on the dais would not be here if it weren't for the tireless efforts of CSIS, and especially as Elizabeth Sullivan. And I know how hard she worked on this, because she was often calling me and writing me and asking me, and we were discussing it. And so I know how passionate and invested she was in making this a success. She did a brilliant job. We all know how immensely challenging it is. There is no more mercurial group of people to try to wrangle than the 18 to 30-year-olds. And undaunted Liz tackled it all. And so we have this opportunity that Dr. Hamry and Derek Chollet and I and all of us have been praising because of her and her efforts and all the people at CSIS that helped her do it. So please, beforehand, let's give a sharp applause. Thank you very much, and on to the next. Hey, thanks. Thanks so much. Nice to see you. Nice to see you, too. Hey, Josh, nice to talk.
All right, well, I didn't deserve that, but thank you, Josh. And you know, this was a fabulous conversation, and our next, we're going to transition now pretty quickly so we can get to Eric Peterson's remarks. And Next America is going to continue, and I really do hope that you continue to engage in this dialogue, even if it's offline, if it's at happy hour, if it's online, and in whatever form, I think that we all will benefit from a continued debate. We are thrilled that GSI, or the Global Strategy Institute at CSIS, will continue this project under Eric Peterson's leadership. And today we are definitely privileged to hear about the next generation. We've talked a lot about the burdens and the problems that we're going to have to face as a generation together, but what happens about people being born today? What happens in 2025 when they're graduating from high school? And they're starting to ask the same questions that we've been posing today. Hopefully we've left the world in a slightly more advanced position, but that's yet to be seen, and I think that we are privileged to hear what that might look like, the various scenarios, the good, the bad, and the ugly, of what the U.S. could look like and what the world was going to look like in 2025. So bear with us as we switch out computers here shortly, and you will not be sad that you waited around for it.
Hi, folks. I'll make this as quick as I possibly can. You see, it's a Mac versus PC issue here. I'm going to go without a microphone. If anyone here has a problem hearing me, as you can tell, that's doubtful. But if you do have a problem hearing me, I'd be grateful if you just raise your hand and I'll go to a microphone. I'd also be grateful if we could find a way to turn down the lights on these screens. That, I think, would add to the gravity of this presentation. What I'd like to do is to begin by acknowledging with deep gratitude the work that Liz and colleagues have done over the past year. It's been a remarkable journey, and those of you who have heard me speak before know that I really think that the millennials, and even those who come after the millennials, the class of 2025, need very rapidly to develop a voice. There are such significant challenges that exist domestically and internationally, all at the given moment, as the preceding discussion has emphasized, all wrapped together in key ways. That I believe that the mandate for voices to emerge in the next generation and beyond could not be more significant than what we see today. Now, I think that we can stipulate that right now, right here, we stand at a remarkable historical moment. Not only do we have a fundamental transition underway here in Washington, but in virtually every significant power center across the world, it is a same planet, different world proposition. We'll be right back. come after will be defining not only the short-term issues, but where things are going in the longer term. That is the essence of the high definition leadership to which you and I need to aspire. Now, I'd like to point out a number of issues going out to year 2025. Now, that seems like a long way away, but in the end, 16 years is really not that far. Translated into days, less than 6,000, less a little more than 140,000 hours, only 8 million or so minutes, and only a half a billion minutes ahead. For your purposes, it means probably 4 significant presidential elections in this country with the chance of equally profound transformations as what you and I have witnessed since Liz embarked in this effort with the help of others here a year ago. And then, God forbid, imagine this. If we maintain the current pace, we're talking about 544 American Idol episodes. I think Paula Abdul will look exactly the same, but I recoil at the thought of Simon 16 years ago. So it's amazing that the high school graduates of that year 2025, are being born around now. I would argue that we can begin to calibrate what we think about their predicament, where they will be in life, by asking this question. When those kids born now, graduating high school in year 2025, reach the podium, what will they say? Will they say, well, thank you for the platform that you provided us, a platform of stability, security, sustainability, the kinds of issues that we heard the panel address earlier? Or will they ask some more uncomfortable questions? And you're likely to be in the audience. Will they be asking, why couldn't you have done more? How could you have let things deteriorate to the level that you did? Well, I think now is the time for us to all be debating and asking these kinds of critical next America questions. And especially the younger people who need a louder voice going forward need to be voicing this kind of thing that the Rockefeller Foundation suggested last year, almost exactly a year ago, that nearly one half of your cohort believed that the U.S. was a better place to live than the 1990s. Now, from my frame of reference, we need to begin. Our point of departure necessarily must be that the U.S. is the hyperpower of the world. Those of you tracking European affairs will remember the expression "épuissance," put together by the then French Minister of Defense. And even now, if you ask the people in Davos, the World Economic Forum, with respect to competition, what is the most significant competitive country in the world? They will argue that it's the U.S., yet again, way ahead of most of the other countries in the world. Now, how can they defend this in the light of the many significant obstacles that we see highlighted day by day now? Well, they argue that notwithstanding the current crisis, that we continue to have the most competitive economy in the world, have had that economy for several years, because of our endowment with structural features that make that economy productive and that put it on a strong footing to ride out the very significant cyclical shifts that lie in front of us. If you follow this debate, you will have seen that the basis for reaching this hyperpuissance argument were very solid. Largest economy in the world, between 22-23%. Tremendously significant resource base. You can tell recently, imagine, we were lecturing the rest of the world about our financial markets and irony is that as you're entering the substantive parts of your careers, that we're beginning to see the symptoms of erosion going forward. The fact of the matter is, and these are difficult statistics, that we leave the rest of the world with a stock of debt. You name the variety of debt when we're on the top. We're now falling behind in terms of export, behind not only Germany now, but China. We're a net importer in this country of high technology. The euro has displaced the dollar in a number of key areas. Our healthcare system is in battle. Bottom line here is continued lack of energy security. We have tremendous, tremendous challenges in front of us. For that reason, the World Economic Forum has dropped us from first to seventh place in IT rankings. $650 billion has been spent on U.S. public schools while we continue to see our situation deteriorate. Imagine U.S. companies spending three times as much on litigation as they do on research. And finally, and this one took the cake as far as I was concerned, we now have more aggregate debt in this country. We all have more aggregate debt than the entire level of global economic output. So as we think about what kind of world we're leaving behind for the next generation, the class of 2025, I would argue we need to begin to express where things are going in seven ways. We need to look at the underlying demographics, fiscal policy, healthcare, education, environment. We need to look at broader physical infrastructure and then ask the question, where is the leadership from you? Where are the voices that need to be heard? Now, the key issue, though, is that believe, the class of 2025 will inherit. What we have is a narrowing base of youth, and look at the shift of the preponderance of the population up the curve. What we face is more nearly an inverted dependency pyramid going forward. What does that imply? It means that the younger age strata will have to work much harder to support the rest of us at the top of the distribution curve. It also means that in your lives, in your careers, intergenerational equity issues could not be more important day by day going forward. Imagine this. You will be ramping up against these kinds of odds in the future. We're talking about in the year 2050, an America in which one out of every five people will be over the age of 65. We're talking about a 65-plus class in this country amounting to some 87 million people. Are you prepared for that? And as we think about this, you need to be bracing for a world in which we boomers are retiring at the rate of about 10,000 people every single day. As far as we know, probably something on the order of 80 million boomers over the next two decades. That, of course, may shift somewhat to the current economic turmoil. Now, also a critical factor in this aging element of this country will be our position relative to other developed economies in terms of those of us who are retired. Look at the rise in median age in Japan, the European Union, and Canada. Now compare that to the U.S. here in red. You can see that because of immigration inflows and the higher population and reproduction rates that they engender, that this is actually a competitive advantage. And it's not only with respect to other developed countries. Have a look at the blue line here, which is China. Because of its own forced one-child policy, the U.S. will probably be a younger country than China in median age terms in the next few years. This is a tremendous issue as we look about where things are going. Consider this. Trends in working age population, age 15 through 64, in some of the major populations across the world. You can see that the U.S. is projected to be strongly positive going out to the year 2050. Canada and the U.K. marginally positive. And look at France, Germany, Spain, Japan, Italy, which faces the prospect of almost a 40% contraction of its traditional workforce out through the year 2050. How will that country make the social adjustment to deal with it? Now, a third key dimension here is the whole issue of diversity. And here again, we're likely to see significant tectonic shifts in this issue of the next America. As we look out to year 2030, we can expect to see significant increases percentage-wise in African-American and Asian populations, while traditional white populations will probably see their numbers diminish. And if we look at this with ethnicity in mind, the changes will be equally, if not more, significant, especially when it comes to Hispanic 12.6 to 20.1% as we look at this America to come. Now, another key issue at work here is where our American family is. And this tracks the world development, so we are becoming more urban by the day. If you look at the percentage of the United States moving rural-urban, you can see a relentless climb. 90% of the population projected to be urban by the middle of the century. We're talking about something on the order of a climb from 101 to 364 million people projected, something on the order of 90%, as I suggested. The big urban areas will be the thing in your future. Have a look at this map. These are the predecessors of the very significant urban areas that play a very significant social political role. Thank you. Walker, the former CBO and the CBO director, who's now the president of the Peterson Foundation. The foundation, I think, is exquisitely named. Has argued that if we stay on our present path, America is likely to see slower economic growth, higher tax burden, rising interest, mounting unemployment, and a stagnant declining standard of living. Now, a lot of this is self-imposed. Here is an anatomy of government dissaving, and it could not be more significant than what we see. We spend more than we get, historically on both sides of the aisle. How can a government tend to try to create incentives for personal savings when it has this kind of a record long term? And as we look longer range, at least according to the GAO, we can argue that by year 2040, three-quarters of every dollar on federal revenue will be spent on retirees and their health care. So what money we do have, including overspending, will be spent on things that we are mandated and not discretionary. Look at the historical graph, and you've got a major X here. You've got discretionary spending falling, mandatory increasing relentlessly. Now, this is the world of the class of 2025. Those kids born today will probably inherit on their birth the equivalent of $184,000 in debt on arrival. And that amount is likely to climb as we go forward. And during the course of their lifetime, as they move toward that graduation stage, here is the map that they'll have to focus on. A front-end focus in the budget process, immediate budget year, tip of nose, ADHD planning, cash base, that is discount or ignore future costs, and then balkanized budget segments. Thanks a lot. What does it all mean? Persistent chronic overspending. And then there's the whole tax bill. Can you imagine that we spend the equivalent of 7.6 billion hours every year? Can't we do something else? Average hourly rate, if we put that at 27, which is pretty generous, that implies $193 billion in opportunity cost dealing with this arcane tax bill. Where are the appropriate incentives here? And finally, how do we create revenues on taxes on income rather than consumption? This is one of the big issues that should concern you as we go forward. Now, this, if we count the number of words in the tax code, how many of these have you got? We're talking about something on the order of 3.7 million. How do we get beyond this? External debt, we've seen significant deterioration as well. And our trustee and counselor here at CSIS, former USDR Carla Hills, has argued that there is no question but that it's an economic proposition of trade deficit is too high. Student who came to the United States as an exchange student. single U.S. state registered at a proficient level in science 2 years earlier. These are all warning signs for the class of 2025. Is it any surprise to you that business leaders like Bill Gates are suggesting that we need stronger schools and better workforce to propel the U.S. economy? We talked about competitiveness issues earlier. There couldn't be a clearer line. And we also need to be thinking about what Craig Barrett, is the chairman of Intel, has pointed to, that nations are only as strong as their educational systems. The rest of the emerging world recognizes this as the key to staying competitive. And here, I'd like you to take a close look. I'm sorry that we don't have as many movements on this screen. But here, have a close look at this. This is a classroom in China. Where is it? Is it in a fancy building equipped with computers? Absolutely not. It is in a cave. You can see the rudimentary light on the top here. And if you can expand the photograph, you see a primitive water tower right on the side. And all of those children are fixed on their teacher here, tremendous commitment going forward. That's China. Here is India. Here are students now at what is called Study Street, the Dalit caste students who are spending their nights, that is, overnight, studying all night, because they don't have lights or there are too many people at home for them to concentrate. They are now studying under public streetlights and actually pushing for more time. This is the competition that the class of 2025 will be facing. Now, at higher education level, we can acknowledge that we are, you and I, are the beneficiaries of some of the finest colleges and universities in the world. If we look at Newsweek's top 100 global universities, we reach the conclusion that 15 of the top 20 are based in the U.S. What great news. But we also need to acknowledge that our position is beginning to fall relatively rapidly. A number of people are suggesting that there's a huge gap in terms of national investment in colleges and universities between the United States and other areas of the world. In higher education, if we look at college graduates, China, India, and the U.S., we get these kinds of asymmetries. And Jeff Immelt, the chairman of GE, has suggested that if we continue to at least not focus on the kinds of issues critical to his organization, that the implications can be profound. He argues that more people, more students will graduate in the U.S. with sports exercise degrees than electrical engineering. So he says, if you want to be the massage capital of the world, we get what we deserve. Clearly, he's pushing for a different outcome.
And so if America's going to compete for jobs, and that's what I mean by competitiveness, can we compete for jobs? We're going to have to find a way to overcome this disadvantage we have in terms of the financial rewards that we've come to expect in this country. And there is probably only one way we're going to do that, and that's by being more innovative and quicker to innovate, which to me means investing in basic research. It means investing in quality engineers that can take that basic research performed by scientists and translate it into products and services. It means to have entrepreneurs and their supporters who can take those products and services and put them into the marketplace. And that, I think, is going to be the big competitive challenge. It's a knowledge economy. Knowledge counts. That's going to be the way we'll get jobs in this new economy.
Thank you.
The opposite question is, what would happen if the rest of the world consumed in this way? Answer, it ain't possible. And we need to think in terms with respect to options for the future. This has huge implications on the environment. We still don't understand the looming impact of global warming on the issues discussed earlier, whether it's water, whether it's agriculture, even the capacity to move forward with energy sources. Air and water pollution are now being overshadowed by global warming. Tremendous issues, land degradation, biodiversity, species extinction, are all working together in ways that we don't fully understand. Off the bridge collapse here with the CNN video for this. think about more distant horizons, you know, 3 weeks in our community, what people from these classes can do. The first one is what we can call more of the same. Continued economic decline, mounting fiscal deficits, continued fiscal generation, and inequity, labor forces falling behind, erosion of global standing, loss of competitiveness, even more by way of hyper-powered climate. The second would be called a limited triage approach. Here, we see a little bit in the right direction, but not enough. Stopgap gaps for a vibrant economy, lowest common denominator, we're seeing it these days after all, erosion relative to rest of the world, persistent polarization. Finally, we can refer to this as a level producing area. And the one for which we need your voice, the one in which you need to dedicate your energies, is what we can call a strategic long-term strategy. We need more by way of a unified consensus approach politically. Authentic, not lip service strategic planning. Judicious investment, priorities and metrics, integrated planning, long-range orientation, a filled-out, future-oriented look at the world, what we can call the hyper-leadership movement. This is an off-footed Abraham Lincoln sentence. As our case is new, we must take into an action. But if there were ever a time, I believe, for us to take this with the seriousness it deserves, it's right now. So with that, I hope I've raised a few issues. If nothing else, I hope this will take us into cocktail party hour in an appropriate way. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for sticking out. Thank you for the opportunity.
Can we do a public announcement real quick? There was a Metro crash on the red and the green lines, so it's either at the Metro Center or the other two that they're at. They were, so just on your travel home.